Obi-Wan Kaizani says, think very small, and in 100 years. Darth Hader says, think only profit and cash, EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. And the Mandalorian responds, think big. Lean is about strategy and transformation. This is the way. You know, you're going to make mistakes, but let's learn from them and not make the same one time and time again.
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple, to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. I am Keith Norris, your host, and our guest today is Randy Kesterson. Randy is a transformational operations leader with over 20 years experience in driving strategic change across global manufacturing and supply chain. He is an author multiple times, soon to be. So happy to have you back here. We had such an interesting conversation that I know we uncovered a few things that we wanted to dig into a little bit more detail here. So just for a little context, we always like to start our conversation off with a little element we call the spark. And a lot of times the spark is this moment or this time in your journey inside continuous improvement where you first realized that there was something here, something of interest. And maybe there was a time in your career or your evolution in your work history where you were first introduced to this concept or realized that it might be something you wanted to turn into a career.
Absolutely. So thanks for having me on again. When I was thinking the other day, and I was talking to a client about this, I've been involved with 45 companies in the last few years, 38 of those being manufacturing companies, and many common themes, but it all goes back to my early days at John Deere when I was a manufacturing engineer and we were creating single piece flow and manufacturing cells. And for me, that was kind of the spark that launched my career into lean, OpEx, continuous improvement, and so forth. So wherever I've been, whether it's in a leadership role or as an advisor to a C-level person or as a fractional interim leader, I always have lean in my back pocket and I'm using it every day, either overtly or covertly to solve business problems. So I go in not attempting to use lean approaches or lean tools. What I'm trying to do is understand what problem is the business having? What can I do to help resolve that problem? And oftentimes, I would say almost every time, it involves a lean solution of one kind.
Awesome. Well, through that experience that you've had in your career, what are some of the problems that you've seen? And have those problems changed a little bit? I know that manufacturing, particularly manufacturing in America, is a huge hot topic right now. Are there some common problems that you've seen, and have those changed in the clients that you're working with?
I think if you drive down to the core and to the root causes, the problems remain the same as they were 20, 30 years ago. And I'm surprised by that, but I think the more systems we put in place, you know, the more we are dependent upon data and so forth, the more often that data is flawed. So most of the clients I work with, and now it's either small cap or medium cap, you know, medium-sized companies, I would say 9 times out of 10, one of the root causes is poor data within the ERP system. Another root cause is the organization is not looking far enough out, so there's no SIOP or S&OP process in place. So the business doesn't have an ability to predict when the next mountain is coming or when the next valley is coming from a demand standpoint. And so those are kind of the two overriding things. Beneath that, oftentimes are lean solutions and lean approaches to help attack those things and to help improve the business results. But oftentimes it's, I guess, what I would characterize as manufacturing 101 issues that need to be resolved first.
Excellent. I'm curious if you have some opinions on this topic of, in the United States, manufacturing has shifted away. There's a political drive to bring more manufacturing back. Are there some insights that you have for companies that are trying to do that on what do they need to do to be successful in that?
In terms of bringing work back to the U.S.?
Yeah, like, I mean, maybe you could talk a little bit to why is it that more manufacturing isn't done here? Where did we go wrong, so to speak?
Yeah, what I think what I've seen over time, and probably 2/3 of my career has been in aerospace and defense. So there's a kind of a protective shield around the defense industry where there's been a lack of ability to offshore a lot of that work. So whether the U.S. is the most competitive source or not, the work has remained in the U.S. With commercial aerospace, there's been an ability to offshore some of that work, and most of it was driven by cost. It certainly wasn't driven by lead time. And then in the commercial industrial world, it's almost all been driven by cost. So I think what I found is when we compared manufacturing in the U.S. to manufacturing elsewhere, oftentimes the direct labor cost was considerably lower. And especially if it was a manual operation, then they could be much cheaper. And so we would forgive the extended lead times and so forth and decide to offshore that work. When there's capital equipment involved, then that's more of an equalizer. And so it becomes, you know, the direct labor component is less, a lower percentage of the total manufacturing cost. So that work is a little bit harder to offshore it. So in essence, what we have to do is somehow tackle that direct labor differential, which is really hard to do with manual work. So you think about the textile industry and some of the others, it's very difficult, I think, to ever justify bringing that work back into the United States because our direct labor rates are just much higher than those other countries.
Interesting. Now, I know that you're pursuing another book right now on the topic of AI. So I'm assuming that you've got some thoughts on where people should be looking, where people might be either excited or maybe concerned about the potential of AI. Do you have some thoughts on how AI might be shaping this discipline?
Now, I'm glad you brought that up. So I'd say 2 or 3 years ago, I couldn't spell AI. And so I'm now able to spell it and know what it stands for. But so the first two books I wrote, my style is interview a lot of people and synthesize what they tell me with what I already know. And so I currently have about 35 people scheduled to interview for that book. And what I'm trying to find is the full spectrum of opinion. So those people who are early adopters and those who are afraid of it and are really trying to push back, and then those in the middle ground who are still exploring opportunities. So for me personally, I think it will enhance lean. It won't replace lean. I think things like predictive maintenance on equipment and things like interrelationship digraphs, which is a lean tool that I learned to use many years ago. Those things that rely on a lot of data, I think, are perfect for AI, and it just enhances our ability to have that information quicker and faster. I know having gone through a interrelationship digraph episode with a number of companies, it takes hours and hours, and it's laborious, and most of it is just simple arithmetic, you know, operations. Things like that, I think it'll really help. But I'm looking forward to talking to all these folks to understand their view, and I'm supposed to have the manuscript to the publisher by October, so it won't be long.
Very nice. Yeah, I think it's definitely quite exciting. There's a lot of opportunity with AI. There's certainly a lot of fear. Some of it's probably founded. Some of it's probably unfounded. I think we've found that AI has the potential to simplify a lot of those manual tasks, and you might say like create some capacity in a lot of certain types of work. So yeah, that's very interesting. Randy, I noticed that you've got put together these cartoons, and you've shared them on LinkedIn and some other places. What inspired you to create these?
So Keith, honestly, I was kind of tired of all the dry, self-important comments about lean on LinkedIn. And I chose this format to kind of poke at some of those concepts in a fun way. And I think it's worked pretty well. Most people know that I'm joking around, and humor kind of breaks down the defensiveness a bit, opens up the conversation. And I think for me, it's been a little bit of lean therapy. So I think it's helped everyone, hopefully.
All right. So talk us through this first one that we pulled up here.
Sure. So this episode was just to introduce the concept of a lean debate. And so the lean expert and the professor were having a conversation, and it all ended up in their members of the offices of the lean establishment. And it ended up resulting in lean debate would be a good idea. And it would probably lead to more book sales on their part. So a win-win for everyone.
So what's the quote about, in theory and practice are the same, but in practice, they're not? That's a good one. I do think that your point about having a cartoon like this, sometimes when you have these situations in life that are maybe frustrating, one reaction is to scream or cry. An alternate reaction is to laugh. So I think that it helps us have something to maybe poke fun or laugh at either ourselves or others and deal with some of these struggles that we have between the theory of lean and the practice of reality.
Absolutely.
Okay, I really like this one. This one has a little bit of a Star Wars theme, which I can relate to a lot. And I think that the Star Wars, the story in the Star Wars is a very interesting one with the heroes and the villains and the, you know, kind of the all-knowing Obi and the heroes themselves, the Luke Skywalkers, etc. Tell us about this one, Randy.
Absolutely. No, I think that these characters are a synthesis of people I've worked with in the past. And so there are real people behind these, but not directly intended to represent anyone. And apologies to George Lucas for this, but the lean debate started with a brief introduction. And so starting on the left, Obi-Wan Kaizani, lean is your strategy and also your religion. On the right-hand side, Darth Vader, he's for mean lean. So he's all about EBITDA, profit, and cash. And I know some people like that. And in the middle is the Mandalorian. And in this case, lean is merely an enabler of your business strategy. That is the way.
I love this analogy because I think that there's, you know, we're all living our own lives, our own stories. And you know, the hero in our own lives, might say that we're all on this, our own little hero's journey. And so every single person is a Luke Skywalker, a Han Solo, a Princess Leia inside their own company. And this thing called lean, I love that you put Obi-Wan Kaizen, because I think that the discipline of lean is kind of like the force, right? Like it's this thing that's mysterious and mystical and nobody really understands it. It's so much bigger than all of us. And it just feels like, it feels overwhelming for somebody to try to like grasp it all and to make it a discipline. And it's almost like we all need somebody to like take it and just hand us a lightsaber and say, look, here's a tool that I can't explain to you how and why it all works, but you can use this tool and you can make a difference. And there's kind of like a fine line between just using the tools and understanding the whole concept. So
absolutely.
I really like this one. That's great.
So now the professor is asking each person to make an opening statement regarding lean. So Obi-Wan Kaizani says, think small, and in 100 years, you might make a tiny impact, maybe. So a million small steps. On the right side, Darth Vader, think bank account, use mean lean for profit and cash, and then EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. And I know people who have said almost exactly that. And in the center is the Mandalorian, so think big picture. And this is really what I advocate. Use lean to execute business strategy. That is the way.
I love that term, mean lean, because I'm a big advocate for tracking benefits on projects in general, and having, you know, pursuit of things like hard savings, but also realize that not every project is going to have hard savings. And in addition to creating hard savings, or you might even say creating capacity, the thing that I see a lot of people miss out on is the opportunity to use that capacity to do some good rather than just, you know, cutting heads. So I like that that term. Lean to describe how some companies use that tool in a harsh way.
So in this case, the professor is asking each of the participants to explain their approach to lean. So Obi-Wan Kaizani says, slow and smooth, believe in the Toyota, note the Yoda underlined, or as opposed to Toyota, the Toyota way. And the lean force, as you mentioned earlier. Lean is a religion. Results don't matter. Go to the Genba. Kaizen forever. Think small. In 100 years, you might. And the Mandalorian's retort is, this is not the way. And Darth Vader is saying, Ibida, Ibida, Ibida. So with regard to religion, one of the things that's bothered me for a long time is some seem to believe that lean was handed down on a stone tablet eons ago, when it's what it's been created by man in the last 100 years and women. And it's, you know, I was doing work at John Deere before the term was even coined. So I have less respect for the philosophy, you know, in terms of a religion. I know it works, but I view it in a different way than some.
I have a perspective on things that I would describe it as like the recipe. I know that you've used a term that I'm a fan of, also the business operating system. And every company, every organization has a business operating system. Some of them have it more documented. Some of them have written books about it. Some of them have been handed off and tried to transfer between different organizations. Henry Ford's operating system could be summarized as the assembly line. And then, you know, Toyota has this thing that we call lean, which in some ways is just the evolution of best practices and truth, and, you know, gets codified into a book, and maybe Six Sigma was the Motorola way or something. So I like that you've got a realistic perspective on what the way is.
I posted on LinkedIn today advocating that all the lean CI OPEX leaders step back and take a bigger picture look at things, you know, including looking at the business operating system, and including looking at how strategy aligns with the lean deployment of the lean execution process underway. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity there, where I think oftentimes we're a little bit too close to the ground, and we're not taking a big enough view of the business as a whole.
Interesting. Okay, we've got another one.
So in this case, the professor is asking Darth Vader for his explanation. So he says, lean is only for cost reduction, period. Customers are a necessary evil. Employees are like assets to be used and then discarded. And suppliers are to be abused and then replaced. Profit, cash, EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. Again, Obi-Wan Kaizani replies, what is EBITDA? And the Mandalorian says, this is not the way. And my point here is, on the Obi-Wan comment, I think there are too many people in the lean CI OPEX world who really don't understand what drives the P&L and the balance sheet. So some education there will really help them in communications with the CFO or his or her team.
Excellent.
So in this case, the Mandalorian reports in and he says, lean is not a religion, nor is it about profit and cash. Lean should enable business strategy and help improve business results. Lean is about respect for all and involves leaders with humility. This is the way. And so if you research Shingo a bit, you know, some of that is taken from him. And Darth responds, EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. And Obi-Wan responds, what is strategy? Again, sometimes the disconnect between what's going on the ground and what the business is trying to accomplish.
Excellent. So we get the right path forward from the Mandalorian.
Yeah, and I think Mandalorian doesn't say this, but I know he advocates for the use of Hoshin Kanri for a number of reasons, to engage leaders in lean, sometimes for the first time, and also to make that linkage between strategy and execution. And the last one is just a chance for each of the participants to provide their lean mantra. Obi-Wan Kaizani says, think very small, and in 100 years. Darth Vader says, think only profit and cash, EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. And the Mandalorian responds, think big. Lean is about strategy and transformation. This is the way.
Yeah, these are excellent. I love these. These are such a good way to kind of put a complex set of thinking around this concept of lean and put some personas with it. So this is excellent. Thanks for sharing these. Now, Randy, you also mentioned Hoshin Kanri there. Why don't you come back to that a little bit? And if for people that might not be familiar with what those two terms mean and what that is, tell us what Hoshin Kanri is.
Sure. So Hoshin Kanri is a term that's existed for decades. And it's really, it translates roughly to policy deployment or strategy deployment. I discovered it many years ago And I've used it with a lot of success in companies of all sizes. I ended up writing a book about it maybe 10 years ago. So I just found that it's a fantastic way to, first of all, make sure we're defining the company's strategy in succinct terms, identifying a small set of strategic objectives, and then linking those objectives to initiatives and projects to execute that strategy. And I think one thing that some people, it becomes overcomplicated because they try to use an X matrix and they try to use a lot of intermediate tools. I see Hoshin and Connery as being mostly about the process and about engaging the different levels in the organization with strategy. I've had leaders, when I posted an X matrix, they'd turn their head sideways trying to interpret it, never could really get it. And so we just went to a simple balanced scorecard format instead, and it serves the same purpose. Likewise, things like the bowling chart, you know, we discard with, people don't understand what catchball means. All those things are secondary to the overall process, which is define strategy, focus on a precious few objectives, and get the organization engaged in executing them.
I love that you bring up catchball, because we had these little balls made to communicate. The idea of like, you know, why it's called catchball, right? You like, hey, I've got a goal. I've got an objective. I've got something that I want to achieve. I want to cut 6% off our operating costs next year. And toss it over. How do you think you could get that? What could you come up with? Well, I probably have this one thing we could do that could save us 2%.
Yep. Absolutely. As the two mistakes, I think, a lot of companies make is they try to take too much on. And so I was working with a large organization not long ago, and they had close to 70 strategic initiatives. And so when you start to cascade that down through the catchball process and it becomes initiatives and projects, that 70 some strategic objectives becomes hundreds of projects, most of which never get accomplished. And so what I found is the key is to have only one, two, or three strategic objectives in a year, develop a number of initiatives and projects in support of that through the catchball process to make sure that they're achievable, and then engage the team to get those things done. So I had a boss years ago tell me that he knew nothing about Hoshin, but he said, our strategic objectives need to be like the burners on top of a stove. You have four pots boiling, don't put another one on until you take one off, whether you stop it, finish it, kill it, which I think is very good advice.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com. I think that's a good visual too, because, you know, you can kind of think through like cooking big dinner. You know, you've only got one oven. There's only one turkey going in there. You got four burners. That's a good analogy. Yep. What might you say? I know that there's a lot of, discussion inside organizations. I've had these discussions, I know others. The difference between strategy, strategic objectives, and tactics. Are there some questions or thoughts that you might use to help somebody shape what those strategic objectives, and maybe some examples of things you've done?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, thinking back to the balanced scorecard, that's something that used to drive the thinking pretty well, was where you tried to put those big picture ideas into different frames, right? Whether it's process, people, financial results, and so forth. And I think there needs to be a balance of strategic objectives, certainly, but it really starts with what is the biggest problem or opportunity the business faces. So, and that comes through the strategy formulation process. And it doesn't have to be weeks and weeks and months, but it really starts with examining externally and internally what are back to the basics, the SWOT, right? Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So where are our strengths internally? Where are our weaknesses? What opportunities and threats do we face in the external world? Most companies look internally pretty effectively, but very few look externally to identify threats that are on the way or opportunities that are on the horizon. So it starts with that. And once you go through that framing, then you can determine, okay, given that, what are those objectives we need to take on for the next 12 months? And oftentimes it might be, hey, we're under threat from several competitors. We need to be able to reduce our costs. And so it becomes a cost-driven set of strategic objectives. Another might be, we're trying to grow. And so we've got a separate set of opportunities we need to go after. And so it really starts with, what does the business need? What are the opportunities or problems that they're facing in that period of time?
Now, I'm sure you're familiar with theory of constraints, TOC, and some of those principles. It sounds to me, I guess you could connect the dots there and say, if you figure out what your constraint is, what's holding you back, most organizations have a growth goal. You know, one of probably seven categories of goals that I most frequently see. Everybody has some version of a growth goal, either revenue or profit or margins or something. It sounds like there might be a connection between like the constraint and a strategic objective.
I think that's a very good point. We're working with a client right now. They want to double their output within the next 2 years. And so when I looked at the business, they're struggling to deliver at their current rate. So let's call it 100. And there are constraints that are limiting them that until we alleviate those, there's no way they're going to double the size of the business. And so within their strategy, that one of the strategic objectives is identify those constraints and then work to eliminate it. And so that's what I'm doing with them. I know what those constraints are, and most of them are operational in nature. And so we're working to eliminate those, which will not only help stabilize the business at its current level, but it'll allow for the business to grow to 2x its size.
One of the experts I was speaking with recently, and I'm sure I'm oversimplifying their thoughts, but they kind of made the point that a lot of businesses for a certain period of time in their evolution will have a market constraint. Like their biggest constraint is just how much demand can they create and then can they generate. And then some businesses will get to a point where maybe it's based on the industry that they're in or a limited resource. They have so much demand that their constraint is now how much or how fast can they deliver against that demand. Is that a pattern that you've seen as well? And have you been on one side of that more than the other?
Yeah. Now my expertise is definitely on the inside and I've seen that time after time. And so I think it comes back to most companies do a poor job of looking out beyond a certain point of time. And most operational people don't do so because they're only looking out. Think about a car driving down the road with his headlights. They're only looking out as far as the headlights can see, right? So it might be weeks, maybe a few months. Well, there might be a turn or a cliff or a mountain that's a quarter of a mile away, and they don't see it until it's too late. So the PSYOP or the S&OP process really helps with that, because most businesses, if you're looking 18 months out, you see those market demand spikes or valleys coming, and you have a time to respond. Either we need more people, we need fewer people, so we need to shift some people around. We need new capabilities, so it might call for CapEx. We need to develop new supplier relationships or outsource more work. But you have a chance to plan for it rather than just react for it. And so I see that as the missing element in large and small companies that would help, alleviate the problem you just described. Once you know what it is, you have a fighting chance to be able to respond to it. But as an operations person, if you're only giving me a few months to respond, you've taken several arrows out of my quiver.
Now, let's drill down on this example and maybe use like a Hoshin scenario. Let's say we do have this goal of doubling the size of the company, the profit, EBITDA, revenue, something like that, and in a manufacturing organization with maybe a 2 to 5 locations or something. How might an objective like that in a Hoshin model get broken down at different levels?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So I think the first question is at the corporate level, what is our total demand? And then we start to look for centers of excellence. So within those 4 or 5 sites, strategically, what are we going to make internally and what are we going to outsource? And for those things we're going to keep in-house, where should they go? And if we're looking 18 months out, that gives us time to make those capital investments or make buy decisions and build the supply base capability if we need to do so. So it really starts at somebody looking at the center you know, on strategic make buy, oftentimes that's delegated to too low of a level. And then it's where are we going to place those capabilities inside the current business?
Can you share some examples of how that goal, like growth, because I know as things like drop through different levels, the goal changes context or changes language entirely. I mean, if you do a good job, you're maintaining the idea that opening this new plant or something is going to help us achieve that growth. But what I'm getting at is sometimes it feels like we have a whole bunch of different goals, but maybe that there's an opportunity to connect those to a strategic objective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Many years ago, I learned about an approach that is think of a matrix, and on the y-axis is top-line growth. And think about a three-year time frame. So on the y-axis is CAGR, compound annual growth rate. And on the x-axis is return on invested capital or return on assets. And so you ask the business to achieve that northeast quadrant. So we want to grow the top line at an aggressive rate, and we want to grow the bottom line equally in an aggressive way, even more so if possible, keeping in mind the capital deployed, right? So it's not just return on sales, but it's return on assets or return on capital employed. And so when you put those targets in place, what it forces the business leader to do is, whether it's organic or inorganic growth, you have to consider, is this going to contribute to our return on invested capital in the three-year time period or not? And so that forces you to make decisions that are not just growth-oriented, because if I'm only in have an incentive to grow the top line, I can do that and sacrifice the bottom line all day long, right? But if I have to do both, it becomes a much tougher equation to solve.
Sounds like there's some leadership work in there in making tough decisions. You know, there's oftentimes when you have a process and you have like a set of instructions you can follow, you might say that's the easy work, perhaps, right? I mean, it's the work that's been done before, but a lot of leadership involves making decisions about things that haven't necessarily been done before. A framework to choose to make what you might call strategic decisions, you know, lean a little bit more like this or a little bit less like that. Sounds like having a framework there could be helpful for.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the time, the framework is an authorization matrix. So as the CEO, you're being given certain authority by the board. And likewise, it filters down. So you allow the people at the director manager level to make mistakes, but the consequences of those mistakes are not going to cripple the business, right? As CEO, you're making decisions all the time based on the best information you have. And so what I've learned is you're never going to have enough information to make a decision. So you have to make a decision with some risk, you know, mitigation around it. And then you swiftly course correct if you're going the wrong way. And so that's what I try to tell people is, you know, you're going to make mistakes, but let's learn from them and not make the same one time and time again. If you're bounding those decisions where, let's say I'm at the director level, I only have authority to make a decision that's worth $50,000 or $100,000. So I'm not going to cripple a business as a result of that decision.
That you used a term there, I think you called it an authorization matrix. Is that something that you'd actually like codify or put into writing? And you kind of gave an example there. Maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit, because that sounds like a term that or a tool that maybe people would be interested in understanding a little bit more.
Sure. So the ones that I've used identify various types of decisions. So let's say it's purchasing. A certain level can sign a purchase order that's valued at $50,000, and I can commit the company to a contract worth $100,000, and I can buy capital equipment worth up to X amount. But the following decisions all require either my boss's approval or the CEO's approval or the board's approval. So it just at a glance, you can see, okay, what am I authorized to decide? And what are the boundaries within that decision making? And so that really helps so that, you know, it helps make sure the business stays in business, and it helps make sure that the mistakes that are made are smaller, especially at the lower level.
I think that's such an interesting concept right there, because you're talking about essentially, ideally in an organization, you want people who take initiative and solve problems and maybe act outside of the very specific set of circumstances that they've been trained on, right? It requires some level of initiative. It's probably easy when you're talking things that require money to make purchases, because you can have controls in there. But I think a lot of companies, I mean, bigger companies are probably better at having lots of bureaucracy and lots of things written. But in small companies, are there some practices or ways that you've seen people try to empower things like innovation and like proposals for things that they should do with, and balancing that with some level of controls so that you don't have everybody running rogue?
Yeah, that's it's a tough balance to strike, because you want people to think on their own, and you want them to make decisions at the lowest possible level. And even in companies with 60 people, you know, the person who's the team leader, you can't allow them to hire and fire people without someone's approval, right? You've got to get human resources or someone involved to make sure that this is an appropriate decision. So even small companies, there are boundaries you need to put around those decisions. But having said that, you can say, okay, we want you to make your decisions at your level, but those decisions we're telling them they can make are not going to put the company at risk, either financially or legally. So that's how I like to operate, is you think about the tiered meetings. Tier one, make all the decisions you can within your job scope. And if you need to elevate it to tier two, great. We'll be happy to weigh in and help out, you know, and try to help you in that area. But if you can resolve it at tier one, please do so. But none of those tier one decisions involve hiring or firing. You know, it involves changes to work priorities and potentially quality decisions and things like that.
You know, one thing I love to do with this podcast is when some of these like terms or acronyms or lean concepts come up, I like to drill into them a little bit. I had somebody give me feedback on one of our early podcasts who was like, I learned some new, you know, business jargon that I'd never heard before. And I thought that was great. So you just mentioned tier meetings, and even just, you know, is tier one at the bottom? Is tier one at the top? Talk about like tier one, two, three.
Sure. So what I found that seems to work best is early in the morning at the start of the shift, there's a tier one meeting, and it involves the people who are actually working in the value chain or value stream with some of their support folks. And they just talk about what happened yesterday, what's planned for the day, and what issues do they need help with. Oftentimes, those issues they raise involve people who are not at that meeting, because it's early in the morning and all the people in the office have not arrived yet. We're still drinking coffee somewhere and getting ready to drive to work. So the tier two folks show up an hour or two later, and some companies, larger ones, have tier two, three, and so forth. But tier two shows up, and the management team comes out on the floor and they say, hey, we need help with an issue that involves engineering, or we need help with an issue that involves a part that's late from a supplier. And so that's assigned to someone, and there's a lot of peer pressure on those individuals to resolve that issue before the next meeting, the next morning, because it's going to come up again. So it helps elevate the importance of the decision, and we assign the right person. And I found it to be very effective.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the so tier one meeting every day, short meeting every day, probably.
Yeah, 10 or 15 minutes.
Huddle. Yeah, huddle used frequently. That tier two meeting, is that a daily meeting or a weekly meeting?
I've done it every day. So it's a good way for the next level to stay plugged into what's going on the floor. I can't remember the last time there wasn't an issue that needed some support. So it's important to have the people there. If you don't do it every day, I've found that people schedule other meetings and so forth. So it's good to get into that regimen, and it only takes 10 or 15 minutes. And if you can't spend 10 or 15 minutes on the shop floor, regardless of what your role is, then something's wrong, because that's where the money's made. You know, that's the value of the stream.
You know, Randy, you just mentioned something that kind of triggered a thought that I've shared in the past, but I think when you think about progressing your career, and you know, folks might be at any different level listening to this, but let's say somebody's like maybe early in their career, they're working at just a, you know, kind of like a staff level, like contributor value stream level, and maybe they're thinking they want to like get into management. Maybe it's somebody's like first time being a manager, and they're such a good individual contributor. They're always on top of it. They've always had their individual stuff together, that they're now in this management role and they're reporting up to that next level. And they have this feeling that they need to like own and control everything. And so their manager says, how are things going? And they're like, hey, everything's fine. Everything's fine. I see you kind of chuckling. You probably have the same. There is a great quote that said, you know, the biggest problem of all is not having any problems. Maybe you have some wisdom for folks that are maybe early in a management role about how to share problems, not in a way that lets you seem incompetent, but in a way that lets you seem like you're on top of it.
Yeah, I've heard some advice from people who say, don't go to your boss with the problem unless you have a solution. I disagree with that because I think a better approach is go ugly early. And I talked to someone earlier this week about exactly that. So I said, if you have a problem, don't wait until it's an emergency. Let us know because we might be able to help you. So, you know, get us involved sooner rather than later. So that's the beauty of the tier meetings is these things bubble up and it gives us a chance and gives us some time to resolve them. And at the lower level, it's not that they don't have the brain power to solve it. They just don't have the authority to prioritize some of these things that need their help.
Yeah, that's such good advice. I find, you know, particularly in larger companies, the role of you know, senior leaders and some of those support functions sometimes is to be aware of things that individual unit or line managers might not know exist, resources they might not know exist, best practices that they might not know exist. So I love that you shared that, the idea, because I do think that that's a thing out there, a meme. People say, don't share problems unless you have a solution. Don't share problems unless you have a solution. I prefer to have people share issues before they become big problems, so that you can, there's so much like wasted time that can be alleviated with, with a little broader perspective.
Absolutely.
That's a good one. Randy, that was so good. Thanks for sharing those insights and kind of having some fun with us on those cartoons. I know for me that gives me a way of thinking about the way to have some of these conversations with people. I think it probably gives people a way to think about their own journey with this thing of lean and you know, so far one direction of the other, but to try to take the best of both sides and to make forward progress. I think that so many of the problems that we have to solve in business specifically are really pretty simple problems when you think about the business objectives. And if you get like too caught up in a particular perspective, man, you can really end up in the weeds. So thanks so much for joining us today and sharing that fun perspective with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Thanks so much for joining us today. And we thank Randy for sharing his expertise with us. And we appreciate your time in listening. If you have a suggestion for a guest or you want to ask a question or have any ideas for episodes or contents, you can share them with me on LinkedIn, Keith Norris. Randy, I suppose we can find you on LinkedIn also.
Absolutely.
Excellent. This concludes this episode of KPI Fireside, a continuous improvement podcast. If you have enjoyed today's episode, be sure to follow us on all the socials and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues who are as passionate about continuous improvement as you are. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.